Morning, August Paul Chesjach. This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is the opening set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. Since 2014, I have been hosting this radio hour and am honoured to have the opportunity to bring to you interviews, talks and performances which speak to the Irish and Irish-American experience. As a historian trained in Ireland, Italy and the US, I have used interviews as a major component of my research, and I am always thrilled and honoured to use the medium of radio to share aspects of educational and ethnic interest. WNYE 91.5 FM is managed and operated by NYC Media, a part of the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Broadcasting throughout the metropolitan area from the 4 Times Square Tower in Midtown Manhattan, it serves the public 24/7 with its schedule of programming. The programming aims to inform, educate, and reflect the diversity of interests that make up New York City's population. I hope you'll enjoy this week's This Irish American Life. On this week's This Irish American Life, I'm really thrilled and honored to be interviewing two of three members of a very important team who've been behind a new book from UCD Press, University College Dublin Press. It's called Redress, Ireland's Institutions and Transitional Justice. Indeed, on this week's This Irish American Life, I'm going to be speaking to two scholars and I suppose we'd say activists and advocates, Dr. Maeve O'Rourke from the University of Galway and Professor Jim Smith from Boston College. Unfortunately, his colleague, Professor Catherine O'Donnell, was unable to make our interview slot, but I'm well assured that Maeve and Jim are well capable of speaking on behalf of the three. I suppose this is one of the most important publications of 2022 in terms of how it attempts to provide, I suppose what the word that I've come up with is a sort of compendium or encyclopedia of reference points and engagements with the whole issue of institutions in recent Irish history. What's unique about this book and what's innovative about this book is the way in which survivors, the people who experienced life in these institutions, are amplified and in a certain way take the lead at the beginning of the book. And this is clearly something that has really shaped recent Irish history. And if any of you have been following very recent events in Ireland and recent allegations surrounding abuse in educational institutions run by particular orders, although maybe a number of different orders, we'll know that unfortunately this is not consigned to history totally yet. And in this way, what Redress does is just so important.
I'm really honoured and humbled in a way to have a chance to talk to people who have dedicated much of their energy over the last few years and few decades in some cases around amplifying and advocating for those for whom this was a lived experience and incorporating their voices into how we come to look at the history of these institutions. And, you know, not only the history in a kind of passive sense, these experiences unfortunately reverberate into the present. They reverberate in terms of how people live their lives in physical ways, in psychological ways, and have real impact in terms of how they face into the latter years of their life. So from that point of view, this is a very timely contribution to the literature on the field. And I'm really, really delighted to have been able to connect with Jim and with Maeve to talk to them about this book. Of course, we're well aware of the great work that our colleagues at UCD Press do. This is just one of a number of fine publications that they've brought to the wider world over the last few months, and I commend them for their work in this vein. So I will be talking when I do eventually shut up here, folks. I'll be handing over to myself in conversation with Dr. Maeve O'Rourke and Dr. Jim Smith, as I said. As a preview to next week's show, I'm thrilled to be speaking to Gerard Shannon, public historian and scholar. Gerard has recently penned a publication on Joseph McDonagh, someone who was very active and significant in the revolutionary period. And Gerard has undertaken a kind of historical recovery project in terms of documenting Joseph McDonagh and his significance in revolutionary circles, etc., etc. He'll also talk a little bit, although I'm hoping that he'll come on and speak to us again in the spring. He has a new book coming out on Liam Lynch. Again, another Liam, a more high profile and significant figure, as I learned from Gerard in this conversation, and not to a long awaited or a new intervention into the biography of this important character. So if you're interested in that kind of history, and Gerard is a tour de force, do tune in to me next Saturday on This Irish American Life, where I'll be chatting to him. But now, to change topics a little bit, leaning into Irish history, in this case, in the context of the institutional history of Ireland in terms of how it has treated its children, and in particular, its unmarried mothers in not a good way at times. And this is a discussion around redress, Ireland's institutions and transitional justice, edited by Maeve O'Rourke, Catherine O'Donnell and James Smith. So I'm handing over to that now, folks. On this week's This Irish American Life, I'm really thrilled to have the opportunity to speak to two people involved in a very important recent publication. It's called Redress, Ireland's Institutions and Transitional Justice, published by our friends at UCD Press in Dublin. And it is edited by Catherine O'Donnell, Maeve O'Rourke and James Smith. Maeve is Assistant Professor of Human Rights at the Irish Centre for Human Rights at the University of Galway, among many other qualifications, titles. And Jim is Associate Professor at the English Department and Irish Studies Programme at Boston College, our friends at Boston College. I'm foregoing lengthier bios because their profiles and reputation speak for themselves in large part. But first of all, thank you, Maeve and Jim, for taking time out to talk to us about your work and this really, really important contribution to the literature in the last year. I think this is something that will stand out as being a really important moment in terms of the topic that is covered. Maeve, can I ask you, for the benefit of my listeners here in New York City and around the world,
would you give me kind of a 101 about the topic? For many listeners in Ireland, they will be somewhat familiar with what you're covering in this collection. But for the benefit of our this Irish American Life listeners, would you kind of plot out what this volume intends to do?
This book, Redress, Ireland's Institutions and Transitional Justice, looks at the question of what justice means and whether justice has been achieved for people who experienced abuse in Ireland's vast network of institutional and family separation abuses in the 20th century. We acknowledge very importantly that actually these abuses are not solely historical because they affect so many people in the present, particularly those relating to family separation where people still cannot find out their identities or the fate of their relatives, but also in terms of relatives still looking to find out the fate of deceased family members and people who are institutionalized still feeling degraded due to the lack of acknowledgement of the wrongdoing against them. We look in this book not only at the Republic of Ireland, but also Northern Ireland's institutions and family separation system, because as survivors tell us, it is so important to acknowledge that borders didn't matter to the religious orders and other organisations involved. And really, we put the people affected at the centre of this collection. Not only do survivors contribute in terms of personal testimony to this book, but many of the contributors from an academic perspective, or several of them, also have personal experience of the system. And so too do some of the contributors from a journalistic and other disciplinary perspective. So the book questions from many different standpoints what a transitional justice approach would mean, if that was something that the states, both North and South, would take to addressing the institutional family separation system. We address the shortcomings of previous inquiries, for example, the Ryan Commission, the Hart Inquiry in Northern Ireland, those two addressing the industrial and reformatory school system. We look at the so-called McAleese Inquiry into the Magdalen Laundries. We look at what happened to people who went through the very recent Mother and Baby Homes Commission of Investigation and the impact of the findings of that commission on people who were affected. Very shockingly, and I don't think this is something that many of your listeners will realise, but the Mother and Baby Homes Commission of Investigation reported in 2021 that there is no evidence that children were forcibly separated from their mothers in mother and baby homes, that there is no evidence that girls and women were incarcerated or forced to enter these institutions by the state or religious actors. It reached conclusions diametrically opposed to what survivors and adopted people have told us and what we know from our own community and family environments. And we look forensically at what the procedures were, you know, not only of the Mother and Baby Homes Commission, but other commissions. We look forensically at the procedures of redress schemes. And then standing back, I suppose, from the legalistic questions, authors in the book address from many other perspectives, whether it is artistic, journalistic, from a memoir perspective, from archaeological studies, what comprehensive reparation would mean. And we use the human rights based concept of transitional justice, meaning accountability, meaning reparation, meaning memorialization and guarantees of non-repetition, as well as accountability. So that multiple pronged approach.
My understanding in terms of, I know your work has obviously, it has been a multi-year topic of engagement, and I think, I suppose, research topic doesn't sound appropriate in terms of like the kind of advocacy and I suppose the activist hat that one needs to wear in this setting. But the book itself, I understand, came out of in large part a physical gathering, a conference around the topic. Was that, I mean, in terms of like creating a space, that did that also enable the, especially I'm thinking of the people directly affected, people who've experienced, this is their lived experience, I don't know, Maeve, if you want to answer this or if Jim wants to answer it. How was that in terms of creating a physical space in which people could somewhat bear witness to their experiences?
It was absolutely essential to this project that it began in Boston College at an international conference, which Jim very much took the lead on organising alongside myself and our colleague, Professor Catherine O'Donnell. For us, having done all of the in-depth academic analysis that this book contains, it is abundantly clear that the testimony and the absolute primary expertise of the people directly affected is the heart of a human rights-based transitional justice response to gross and systematic abuse and constitutional and human rights violations. Too often in the past, in Ireland, both North and South, the archive has been allowed to lead, although unfortunately it's been allowed to lead in secret, and at the end of the process, the people affected have no access to that archive. But one of the very poor practices that we have seen is that testimony and lived experience has almost come as an afterthought to particularly the Mother and Baby Homes Commission of Inquiry, but also others, and procedures haven't been set up from the beginning to give that testimony the respect it deserves. Meanwhile, however, giving testimony from alleged wrongdoers, greater weight as well. So it's not that all testimony is dismissed, but unfortunately there is even a hierarchy within the testimony gathering. And often it is records that have been created and then held by the institutions that have run roughshod over what the people affected have to say about the human impact of the various practices and institutions. I suppose the fact that we had many people directly affected at the core of that conference has run right through to the heart of this book, and it begins with the survivor testimony from the panel of victim survivors that was held at that Boston conference. And you will see, if you read that victim survivor testimony, you will see its themes run right through the book, which is, again, in itself to demonstrate the expertise that is coming from survivors and the absolute need for those in government who wish to respond, and anybody today who wishes to know how it is that structural discrimination has come to be and how our institutions could be made more equal. It's so important to actually listen carefully to that great experience that is coming from people who suffered some of the worst human rights violations in Irish history.
What strikes me and what struck me when I heard about the book and your work, your collective work in this vein, was how are we at this point still in 2022? You know, if I remember correctly, there is the Ryan Report 2009. How are we still grappling with the point of the collection in a way, and the points you were making so eloquently, Maeve, are we haven't actually, as a society, fully grappled with the reverberations of what the impact it had on individuals and families. And I suppose by you amplifying in the very first instance, and that's what I loved about the collection from the get-go, was how prominent the lived experiences, the testimonies are of people involved. That's where we kind of have to start from in terms of moving forward. I don't know if either of you have any remarks on that.
I would just say that a few points that come out of what survivors tell us are the shoehorning of certain people into certain forms of inquiry does not sit well with the people affected themselves. The fact that survivors and relatives have been separated out from each other, and some people who are in some institutions have been given a hearing, inadequate as that hearing may have been, by inquiries, and some people have been included in redress, but not everybody affected by a certain practice. And even the fact that whole swathes of institutions have been seen as disconnected from others. So there are many people who experienced abuse, for example, in the psychiatric institutional system that made their way then were transferred into the church-run laundries or mother and baby homes, or were taken from industrial and reformatory schools. So even the picture that we have at the moment of what constitutes institutional abuse in Ireland is entirely incomplete. And the people affected themselves would point this out because, of course, they themselves and people that they know and family members of theirs have, as one individual or as one family, experienced, you know, a system that's far bigger than what has actually been recognised as abusive to date. So that's one problem, the compartmentalisation of people and the limiting, always limiting of the inquiries and redress schemes. Then what often comes up is that the government has established monetary forms of so-called redress in a way that paints the people affected to the general public as individuals who want money above all else. The general public often doesn't understand even the very limited amounts that are at stake. For example, the mother and baby homes proposed redress scheme that is going through the Oireachtas at the moment and would offer €1,500 in recognition of up to 6 months forced labour in a mother and baby home. And I think what matters a lot to victims and survivors is that this focus on monetary redress that the government creates takes the focus away from accountability. For example, the lack of inquests for families who want to know the fate and the whereabouts of deceased relatives. The fact that there have not been criminal prosecutions, and even though the Gardaí very recently have invited complaints, they have not actually seized the archives that would help to substantiate what survivors are coming forward to complain about, nor have they demonstrated, to be honest, an understanding of anything other than sexual and physical assault. They haven't come forward, you know, our national police force, to demonstrate that they understand that false imprisonment and abduction constituted crimes, child stealing, that forced labour was criminal. So the lack of accountability is very much to the forefront, I think, of many survivors' minds. And then when it comes to that question of redress, they have very concrete needs. For example, healthcare, for example, clinical psychology services, physical therapy services, occupational therapy, amendments to or adaptations to their house. And it's those concrete forms of rehabilitation and reparation that are not being provided. And instead, I suppose, the government is presenting a picture to the general public of payments being made to these people, quote unquote. It's a very important poem in our collection by the amazing Connie Roberts that tackles this notion of, quote unquote, these people. And instead of actually listening to these very eloquent, very generous, very thoughtful people and responding to their real concrete needs, they are painted in ways that actually take focus off the real accountability and the real rehabilitation measures that are required.
I'm conscious of your time, Maeve, and I thank you for coming on, and Jim is sitting patiently there, and you're not getting away this easily, Jim. I have some questions for you, but Maeve, I want to ask you, in your experience, in terms of your expertise, I'm sure you've thought of this or kind of looked into this. Is there anywhere in the world that has gotten this right, or, well, at least better than what we've done? Like, are there places that you've been able to look to, or examples of, you know, because we know that this, it wasn't, you know, we're looking at a primarily Catholic Church kind of culture. And we know it did happen in smaller congregations and things, but this has been a global scourge in cultures in which the Catholic Church have dominated. Are there places that you've looked to in terms of what you lean into so well in your approach to all this?
I'd say two things. It's a really important question. One is that in Ireland, as in many countries around the world, we actually have a legal system that purports to respond, and for many people does respond to, very serious abuse. we have a functioning criminal justice system, we have a functioning court system, we have things like personal injury, payment guidelines, we have an inquest system. One of the problems is that it does not seem to operate. It does not, in fact, operate in the interests of people who were institutionalized and forcibly separated from their families. It's almost as if the abuse is so great and so systematic that the powers that be couldn't countenance allowing our ordinary justice system loose on it. And instead, this abuse and the people affected are funneled off into what are described as specialized, dedicated measures of investigation and redress. And what actually is happening is, once those inquiries are set up, all of the relevant evidence is gathered and made unavailable to the police, to the inquests, to lawyers for the purpose of going to court or demanding personal injuries. And then once people are offered dedicated redress scheme, they are required to waive away all of their rights that they'd ordinarily have to take the state or the religious to court. So that's one answer, that where have we seen a model that would work? Well, actually, every day of the week, if you were to imagine yourself being arbitrarily detained or a family member of yours being taken away from you without any due process, well, I think I know where you'd expect to receive your accountability and redress from. And that is one thing, you know, survivors will point out, that we have, you know, personal injury guidelines in relation to these types of harms, but just in a different context. And then the other answer that I think is important, and we definitely point to in our work, is when it comes to truth telling, which, as you can probably tell from everything I've already said, is, I think, we argue, central to the kind of non-functioning of the democratic state, this secrecy that just creates this inertia, because those in control of the records and even of testimony have made it secret so that it can't go anywhere. So truth-telling is at the heart of the transitional justice response, because I suppose it deals with the fact that gross and systematic human rights violations often happen at the hands of those who then have the control over the evidence. And so you ensure that the truth is opened up so that other responses can follow. Where we have seen useful and survivor-focused truth-telling, I think we have two good examples that we often point to. There are many others in the world. We have the Stasi Records Agency in Germany, which flows from a policy and human rights-based and legal decision that it is justified to open up records that may name people who caused you harm in the interests of truth-telling, because you have been subject to abuse and society needs to learn from that in order to not repeat it in future. So in Europe, we now have the EU General Data Protection Regulation, which unfortunately is tending to be used as a sword against people actually who are looking for their information. Institutions are saying, oh no, we can't hand out records because they name other people, whereas we see the Stasi Records Agency operating under European Union data protection law in Germany. And so that, I suppose, from a legal perspective, is a very important example. The Canadian National Centre for Truth and Reconciliation in the University of Manitoba is such an interesting example also of a dedicated, permanent, education-related and based archive that gathered and is protecting all of the evidence that came forth through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada. And it is run very much by survivors and people affected. There's a governing circle of people affected who really impact how that archive is used. And like I say, it's in a university setting, and the purpose of it is to ensure change into the future. And that's something that we absolutely want to see in Ireland. So as we point out in the book, we have been very involved, and many of our contributors have been involved in advocating for and in demonstrating I suppose, what the legal and other foundations could be of a national centre for research and remembrance that the government did commit to and has in the last budget allocated funding to, that will be housed in the last Magdalen Laundry site to close in 1996 at Sean McDermott Street in Dublin City Centre.
Maeve, I know you have to go. I'm very grateful that you've taken time out to speak to me today, and so my listeners could hear from you. Your work is so important, and I know by the passion in your voice and in what you do and what you say and what you write that we're in good hands in terms of you continuing to amplify all that we need to address in this, on this issue. Thank you so much. And I'm going to, you left us on a really good point there for, so I can pick up with Jim on some of the transnational elements. Thank you so much, Maeve. A pleasure to meet you. Jim, as I said, Maeve so nicely there, it wasn't planned, kind of brought us over to a North American example in terms of some of this work. And maybe, you know, you're based at Boston College. Would you tell us a little bit about your, maybe your kind of journey intellectually into this field?
Thanks, Miriam. And it's not easy to walk in the footsteps of Maeve O'Rourke. And I do have, maybe before I answer that question, I might just, because you're editing, I might just provide little add-ons to the couple of the answers. Go back to the first question you asked Maeve, but it connects to what you just asked me. The three of us, and you know, the three of us, I should mention, so Professor Catherine O'Donnell, Dr. Maeve O'Rourke, and myself, are joined by Claire McGettrick and Mary Steed as the five members, the founding members of Justice for Magdalens Research, which formerly was Justice for Magdalens. And that's how we first kind of engaged with this issue, centralized on the issue of attaining justice for women who went through, some left and others died in Ireland's Magdalen Laundries. And we had the Taoiseach's apology in 2013. But through that work, we always imagined and we always understood beyond living survivors, we always kind of, living survivors in Ireland, we always considered the diasporic aspect of this particular, these particular aspects of Irish history. And there's a diasporic element to each of the different kind of communities, because there's not a one size fits all that survivors of the Magdalen Laundries may have had an experience in an industrial school as a child, but they may not. Some women in the Magdalen Laundry gave birth to a child in a mother and baby home, but many others did not. But regardless of what institutional community you're talking about, there is a diasporic element to it. And here, speaking from Boston, the United States, perhaps the largest single component of that diasporic community are the 2,000 plus children who were sent to America for adoption, a process facilitated initially by the Irish state and the American embassy in Dublin, at a time when adoption was still not legal in Ireland. Ireland legalized adoption in 1952. It came into force in January 1953. But we know that children were being sent in their dozens and then in their hundreds from about 1946 onwards. That community was represented at the Boston College conference in 2018 in the person of Mary Steed, would be just one example. But there were many more. And in my journeys and in my travels as an academic, I remember giving a talk at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and the front row was constituted by three families for whom this was personal and this was real. And likewise here in Boston, I think about Michael Byrne, who I've met many times, who was also one of that community. You asked about my own personal journey. I suppose I trained as an academic. I did a PhD that looked at institutional abuse. And then I focused on the Magdalen Laundries for my book. It wasn't until after my book was published in 2007 and then by Notre Dame University Press and then by Manchester University Press in 2008 that I was sitting here in my office at Boston College and my phone rang. And it was a woman from the Irish community in the larger, the greater Boston area. And I knew instantaneously, I've written about this. It was a halting voice. And she said, are you the man who wrote the Magdalen book? How do you know my story? And that woman, I can now identify, she passed away in 2016. And I always respected her wish that I not use her name until after she had passed. But Catherine Whelan had been placed in the New Ross Magdalene Laundry just after her 14th birthday. Her mother had passed away when she was 7, and her father subsequently married, and the children from the first marriage were not welcome in the second marriage home. So she, Catherine, was sent at 14 to New Ross, and a 12-and-a-half-year-old sister was put on the train and sent to Limerick, where she didn't enter the industrial school. There was an industrial school for children in Limerick, as there was in New Ross, but both sisters were put in to work with the predominantly adult and older population of women in the Magdalene Laundries. Catherine would stay there for just over 4 years, was sent to a job in a hospital run by nuns in Dublin, the orthopaedic hospital in Dublin, and then within a few months got herself to England. But in her own words, she would say, London wasn't far enough away. So she, in the early 60s, landed here in Boston, where she worked as, first of all, in janitorial services, and then worked her way up to be an assistant to nurses in a main hospital here in the city. But she never trained as a nurse. And for Catherine, and for Catherine specifically, her greatest loss was the loss of her education. That's what she would say. And that's what she said to the day she died. She compensated for that by spending a life reading books. She was an avid reader. And she ultimately, later in life, returned to the Catholic Church, and in her final decades was a daily communicant. But Catherine was somebody who needed help. And she found herself in her mid-70s, living outside of Boston, with completely dependent on Social Security. And at that stage, she had been providing home health care since she retired. She was providing home health care for an elderly woman in her 90s in return for free room and board in an apartment in a triple-decker. So she was living in the basement. But that woman in her 90s had to be put into a nursing home. And in order to pay for the nursing home, the family had to sell the house. So Catherine was faced with being put out on the street. And she needed help. A number of us, not me alone by any means, made an application to the Irish government to see whether she'd be eligible for a pension to augment her Social Security here in the States. And she was turned down. She was lacking by 4 points on a 100-point scale. So they offered her €12 a month, which an Irish bank took 5 of in terms of to convert it and to transfer it. It was pretty horrendous. It was an eye-opener when it happened. But Catherine finally did get her pension, and she got her lump sum payment. She only had a few years to enjoy it before she passed. But Catherine used that money to ensure that she was cremated and that her remains were brought back to Ireland, to County Westford, where she was buried along with her mother. So that's the kind of diasporic story. It's also the entryway for myself into this kind of work.
That's something that struck me when Maeve was speaking there, Jim, and as you speak to it, and I've seen it myself as a historian of diaspora too. You don't have to go very far, and in all parts of the Irish diaspora, you encounter Catherine Whelans, right? And you encounter them in different ways in terms of an adoptee, you know, someone who was brought to the US. I'll never forget, Jim, when I was not long in the United States. It was actually probably when I was doing my first round of oral histories in 2006 or 2007. And at the time I always regretted not asking the woman more, but this woman was a nurse from Dublin who had worked with the Irish Adoption Agency to physically bring those children to the US from Ireland. And she had given up the work because she found it, now, as I would say now, too traumatic in terms of she wasn't happy with some of the homes she was leaving these kids in terms of their capabilities. And I know that didn't happen. You know, I know people who had a very good experience in terms of the families. You know, I'm sure you're like me in terms of the Ireland we grew up in. We encountered these. They were so part of our histories, of our communities and our our interactions with people who'd survived those institutions, and certainly in the diaspora, this feeling for those who could get away maybe and distance themselves in that eloquent way you described, Catherine, describing. I suppose then in the arc of your research and engagement with the topic now, which is nearly a couple of decades, Jim, is there progress being made in this journey that we're on in terms of righting these wrongs or no?
Well, there's a couple of ways to answer that, Miriam. I mean, I think, yes, there's progress to be, progress has been made, but there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. I mean, I came to the United States in 1991 to start my graduate studies, having grown up in Sligo in the northwest of Ireland, from a middle-class family, a working-class family, five siblings, large family. I never heard the term Magdalene Laundry until I came to America. I mean, it really was Patricia Breck Brodin, who we lost this past year, such an amazing person, who gave voice to and helped narrativize that particular story. And it was those brave and courageous voices of the 1990s who began the first generation of people, not technically the first, but the first to get published, generation of survivors of Ireland's industrial schools, who bravely began to commit their stories and their testimony and their truth to memoir. And so the advent of life writing by people like Paddy Doyle, and I have them here, right here on my shelf beside me, Manix Flynn, Bernadette Fahy, and others. And I think those memoirs in particularly fed into the first documentary, Dear Daughter, and then the powerful three-part documentary by Mary Raftery, States of Fear. Mm-hmm. We're speaking out and telling stories. And I often evoke Mary Robinson, her inaugural address, where she spoke about her presidency being a presidency of stories of justice included. And so the decade of the 1990s began to articulate something that certainly in the Ireland I grew up in the 70s and 80s would have been brushed under the proverbial Irish carpet.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think with representation through film and theatre and art, but also the formation of survivor groups and a sense of activism and advocacy around survivor groups, I think this movement, and that's the word that three of us certainly kind of see this work as contributing to, this movement found a special, I don't want to embarrass her or point any one person, but certainly the impact of Maeve O'Rourke bringing the Magdalene issue to the United Nations Committee Against Torture in 2011, and the fact that the UN echoed the Irish Committee, Commission for Human Rights, which had also called for an formal inquiry. But when the United Nations the following year called for the same thing, it was patently clear that the Irish government would have to act. And so I think another ingredient in propelling this movement forward, you know, and the United Nations Committee Against Torture was followed by a further five UN bodies that found similarly on the Magdalene issue, and then more recently on mother and baby homes, and most recently still on the issue of systemic racism within Irish institutions. And I know you spoke to Jude Hughes just a few weeks ago, and that was a powerful piece of advocacy. But the role that human rights and human rights discourse has had in terms of empowering and driving members of the various survivor communities forward suggests and underscores that there has been progress. The flip side of the coin are all of the issues that Maeve spoke to and that I would echo is the long history of the Irish state continuing into the very present, into this year, into actions and choices and decisions made in the last 3 to 6 months, whereby the Irish state compartmentalizes, it minimizes, it ignores survivors' truth. The use of the word stories is objectionable. This is testimony, evidence, part of our national heritage. But the compartmentalization of response, of the state's response, is evident in the ways in which it has treated as separate something that a set of issues which are related to institutional provision and adoption, forced family separation, which were part of a wider system. These were interdependent. The judicial and statutory language which empowered and regulated many of these institutions fed into the system of course of confinement, as defined by Owen O'Sullivan and Ian O'Donnell. My term for it would be an Ireland's architecture of containment. So the Irish state compartmentalizes. It minimizes in terms of its response primarily being one driven by financial redress. Too often ex gratia, in other words, it's redress, financial compensation given as a gift or in the gift of the state rather than as an acknowledgement and a recognition of wrongdoing, of criminal action. And yeah, it further minimizes survivors' agency and their dignity by forcing them to sign away other legal rights in order to be able to access their financial payments. So there's a whole other way, set of ways in which the state minimizes this aspect of our collective past. And then it stymies truth-telling. And I think that's for us who are on the academic end of this conversation. I think we, in a special way, understand the ramifications of a cultivated ignorance, of a systemic manner in which we are not allowed to know. I mean, survivors, first and foremost, are stymied from knowing who they are and where they come from and what happened to their family and to their natural parents in the past by being refused access to information. The first corrective, the first significant corrective action in that regard was introduced on the 3rd of October 2022, when for the first time an adopted person in Ireland can apply for access to information and early life files, including their birth certificate. For the first time, prior to that, any information which would have been forthcoming was so heavily redacted that it was largely unhelpful. So now there is a process in place whereby the adopted community in Ireland can have the same benefit that Jim Smith has. I can walk into the GRO and ask for my birth certificate as an Irish citizen, person who's born in Ireland. If you're adopted, you didn't have that right. Mm-hmm. And now you have access to that information. But even so, that new legislation, while it provides access to information in the government's possession, so we're talking about personal information about identity in the government's possession, it chose in 2022 not to afford the same right to unmarried mothers, or to the mothers of those children, women who gave birth to a child in one of these homes. The state has information about them, about who they were at that particular moment in life, how they were characterized by the institution in which they entered into, information, medical information, key medical information about how they were treated or not treated, whether pain medications were given or denied during childbirth, something that testimony from so many women speaks to, information about whether or not they were in the right frame of mind and whether they were fully informed before signing a consent order for their adoption. So there is information in the possession of the state. There's information in the possession of the Catholic religious orders who ran many of these institutions, not all of them. And access to information is crucial to truth-telling, both for survivors, especially for survivors and their children. This is also an intergenerational issue. It affects families from multiple generations. But I also think, going back to the first part of my point, it's crucial that in an appropriate, professionally archived manner, that academics have the opportunity to engage with this information so that we can rewrite, and that's what we're talking about, rewriting the history of 20th century Ireland, because so much of this information we have been denied access to, and it fundamentally changes and alters our understanding of the nature of the relationship between church and state, the role of Catholic religious in Ireland, the treatment of the poor and the underclasses. Absolutely. Doesn't seem enough to say the patriarchal or chauvinistic, perhaps misogynistic treatment of women in need and women in care. the position of the vulnerable or the precarious child. There's a whole set of histories and a whole set of narratives that need to be re-examined so that we know in a different way and know the social realities and the lived experiences of a population which could have numbered up to, according to Ona Sullivan and Ian O'Donnell, a full 1% of the Irish population in 1951.
To bring it back, Jim, to the book, to Redress, you know, I guess, like, it's almost, I don't know whether anyone has described it as a compendium. It's like an essential compendium of different ways in which, to your point, in terms of this vital aspect of Irish history that we need to really engage with. Has this book, or how has, it's out a few months now, how has it been engaged with in terms of what Maeve very eloquently set out in terms of what it's trying to do? I suppose in terms of the reception towards it, Jim, what have you kind of noticed in terms of how it has been received?
Well, it's still early in its life. So it came out in May. We were in Dublin for the launch at the National Museum, Collins Barracks, at the very end of May. It is, I should add, it will be distributed here in the United States through the University of Chicago Press. And there is a link on the University of Chicago Press's website already. So if one is interested in purchasing the book using dollars rather than going across the water. It's very early to think about reviews in academic journals where we'll be looking at. There's been a fulsome response through the Irish media when the book came out, with a lot of radio interest, a couple of very strong features pieces, piece by Clodagh Finn in the Irish Examiner. The first two reviews came from a wonderful historian, such an important voice, Ireland's first professor of Irish gender history, Lindsay Erner Byrne, mm-hmm. reviewed the book in the Sunday Independent a couple of months ago. Because the three of us are also members of JFM, we also think it's very important, you know, we trust that this book will find its way into academic journal reviews. I hope it does. As we outline in the latter part of the introduction, we do see this as a challenge to the interdisciplinary field of Irish studies. I think we're trying to promote and imagine a different kind of Irish studies, an Irish studies that is engaged comparatively with international best practice. So we have articles on Canada, Australia, and the UK child migration scheme. An interdisciplinarity that goes far beyond. And I know you've worked for decades in an Irish studies context. So I'm preaching to the choir. We understand that Irish studies has long gone beyond the bedrocks of English and history departments, and we only need to do more of that. I think programs at NYU and at Notre Dame and at BC and many other places too, have folks working on Ireland and performance and drama, sociology and politics. And certainly I think this collection of essays and the disciplines it brings and the perspectives and the multiple perspectives it attempts to bring to this set of, issues draws strength from a plurality of critical perspectives, from philosophy and sociology to archaeology and heritage, from literary scholars to creative writers, journalism, legal scholars, human rights scholars, legal practitioners. But building upon, and I'd echo Maeve in this, and prioritizing as a point of departure the voice of survivors. The first section, the book is in four sections. The first section is a section entitled Truth Telling. And the first essay in that Truth Telling section is an essay entitled Testimony that brings together the evidence of eight survivors from Ireland, from the UK, and from the US. And again, there are survivors from the US, and I have very fond memories of something that happened in the room in Gaston 100 on November the 2nd, 2018, when it was obvious that I think we, the academic community, were probably made nervous or anxious when we suddenly realized that our expertise owed so much and could only be enhanced by listening to and taking on board the real experts in the room. And there were many in the audience, folks who on their own, out of their own pocket, made it their business to fly. I remember meeting Anna Corrigan from TUM, who, you know, and it's disgraceful on one level that she had to pay for her ticket to come to Boston to attend this conference. I had reached out to Irish government departments to see if I could get funding, and it was only forthcoming from one particular department. But there were others who came from Ireland and came from Canada and came from across the United States to be in the room for that conversation.
Jim, you described so well there the vastness, and I suppose Maeve touched on that as well from a kind of more legal perspective, the vastness of the ways in which this touches on our history and their intersectionality. You know, my work in terms of the experiences of people of African descent in Irish contexts. You know, you've Conrad Bryan in here and you've Rosemary.
Rosemary Adasser,
you know, people who've been in the trenches for a long time. And I know in different contexts, Jim, how important it is to see the academic community and the advocates amplifying those voices. This really, really, like, honestly, it's a really, really important book. And I hope that people take the time. And it's such a wonderful collection of voices, not only the voices of survivors, but some of our really talented people in terms of articulating experiences. I know for some of our listeners, for example, Dan Barry from the New York Times, someone we know and are very fond of, his wonderful piece on the lost children of TUM, and many others. This is a real go-to collection. Again, the name of it is Redress, Ireland's Institutions and Transitional Justice. It's edited by Professor Catherine O'Donnell. It sounds like she's had a promotion since the book was published, and brava on that. Dr. Maeve O'Rourke, who was on earlier and is just a force of nature herself as well. Dr. Jim Smith out of Boston College. Jim, thanks for bringing this. It was on my radar, but enabling me to share this with our listeners to this Irish American life. I know people are very interested in the general topics, and I think what you do in this collection is just so important for the moment we're in, not least because I'm sure you're following in Irish media, Jim, recent revelations in terms of the Spirit and Order. My gosh, some of the newspaper coverage today in terms of what's going on. This isn't actually history yet, and we have to learn from it and we have to do better. Jim, keep up the good work, and I hope I get a chance to cross paths with you again. And again, thank you for facilitating this interview with yourself and Maeve today. It's been a real pleasure to connect with you on it. And I commend you and everyone at UCD Press, and particular the survivors who've contributed in a beautiful way to this important collection. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Miriam. It's great.
This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records.